Welcome to episode 18 of Unframed, a podcast which hosts talks and conversations about South African art and artists. I am your host, Anthea Pockroy. Today's episode is another recorded talk from the Art Fair Week in September of this year, 2019. It was recorded at Art Joburg and is a conversation about the great and influential David Kulwane, who passed away at the age of 81 in June this year. I was so happy to hear that this talk was happening at Art Joburg, as I was planning an episode remembering the life and work of David Kulwane. Both speakers, art historian and curator Thembinkosi Goniwe and Goodman Gallery curator Justin Davey, worked intimately with David in the last few months of his life, pulling together his prolific and profound body of work for a major retrospective exhibition. Fortunately, David was able to see the first incarnation of this exhibition at Iziko National Gallery in Cape Town in June this year, but sadly would not live to see its second incarnation at the Standard Bank Gallery in Johannesburg, which opened just last week and runs until the 6th of December. Thank you to Art Joburg for allowing me to record this talk and to publish it on Unframed, and to Thembinkosi and Justin for an insightful and poignant tribute to David Kulwane.
In mourning the passing of David Kulwane, former President Thabo Mbeki described Kulwane as an outstanding artist and a loyal fighter for the liberation of South Africa. This has in fact been elaborated on by Kulwane, where he says, and I quote, "My concern in socio-political matters and contributions to the furtherance of disadvantaged black South African artists during and after the apartheid era is evident. My work can be said to reflect the socio-political landscape of South Africa, both past and present. The socio-political conditions created by the apartheid system of the government have to a large extent transfixed the human condition as the axis around which my work evolves. The human figure has become the icon of creative expression." End quote. Those are the words of the formidable David Kulwane. But of course, this socio-political aspect of David Kulwane should not, however, take away from the fact that besides being a devoted fighter for the liberation struggle, he was just so much more. Born in Johannesburg in the township of Alexandra, Ntate Kulwane, as he was affectionately known by others, had a career that spanned over 40 years. Throughout his career as an artist, he also wore many hats as a mentor, an art critic, a scholar, and a curator, amongst other things. Ntate Kulwane, as many of you may know, was also one of the founding members of the Bag Factory, one of the most resilient cultural institutions that continues to give oxygen to the contemporary art space in South Africa and the African continent. Leading this panel discussion today on this monumental figure, David Kulwane, is artist, art historian, and curator from Rhodes University, Mr. Thembinkosi Goniwe. The gentleman seated right there. And joining him is curator from the Goodman Gallery, Justin Davey. Can we please give them a round of applause? And they will ensue the conversation. It will take about an hour. And in the last 15 minutes or so, we will engage in a Q&A session. Thank you. Gentlemen, over to you.
Thank you, Thabang. And thank you for coming. You could be somewhere else. It's Sunday. You could be in church. You could be looking at art. But we really appreciate your time coming here. Thabang has made a comment about David, whose career started later in his life, starting in the 70s, and mentored by the South African artist living in exile, Louis Maqubela, who also encouraged him to work with the late Bill Ensley in the 70s. And David, he had many caps as an artist, as a curator, as an initiator, as an educator, as a mentor. So I'm struggling where to start. Perhaps I should ask Justin, because what we've done in the last 8 months or so is to produce an exhibition that is a short survey of his work. And I had the fortune of working with Justin, who represented Goodman Gallery. And he spent most of the time, David's last months, so visiting him at the hospital, also visiting him at his house, also looking at the work. Perhaps Justin can help us to say, how was it to spend those last months with David?
Thank you, Tembi. Thank you all for the opportunity to speak. And sorry also for being a bit late. I think we can be encouraged by the words of Abdullah Ibrahim, who speaks about arriving with perfect timing. And I'll use that as an anecdote for my late arrival today. But also, I think it's a interesting metaphor for David's life. He started studying to be an artist, or training, or in earnest trying to be an artist relatively late in his life compared to contemporary times. But he didn't waste any time once he started going. He was, as Tembi and Tabang have said, he was a multifaceted creative person, not only in his mark making and his art producing, but as a curator, as a thinker, as a writer. And that brings me to the next metaphor around time, which was, as Tembi mentioned, this retrospective that we've been busy putting together. Many people believe that it's way overdue. But I think we somehow got there just in time. David was able to see the exhibition that we curated in Cape Town. So I think I'd like to use that lens, maybe the lens of time, to think about David's work. A lot of the themes and the subject matter that he worked with, he engaged with over a long period of time. If you think about the dogs, Mgodoy, which were there from the beginning right until the end, his engagement with the cityscapes of Johannesburg, and the stories that he's told about how Johannesburg has changed from the apartheid times to now. So I think that's maybe an interesting place to start, Tembi.
Yes. I want to... I've proposed to think of David as a modernist artist, although he was reluctant to accept that in a conversation I had with him. By modernist, I mean someone who's concerned with modern times, someone who's concerned with the city, because David's preoccupation was Johannesburg, the cosmopolitan. And of course, he's not only just a modernist, he's a belated modernist. If you think of that project, whether you look at the likes of Celsus Quotnes, for example, you look at Emma Stern, I'm just mentioning South African artist. And then if you want to cross abroad, you look at Picasso's, you look at Matisse, all those artists who dedicated to paint the condition of their time, and David was one of those artists. But as a reluctant modernist, David spent most of his time searching for a language to draw, and was invested in mark making. And if you look at his work, you'll find this constant search of this language of mark making. And at times you'll see the struggle, because he didn't have like what one would call formal education in terms of tertiary. He worked with the likes of Bill Ensie, this kind of organic teaching, mentoring, which later he translated himself in educating other people. But also David went to study as well formally, because I think he's the first in South Africa to have a museum studies in the 80s, when that was not heard of. Of course, he didn't talk about that much. And in addition to that, he also, David wrote at a time where there were few black writers in the visual art space. There were likes of Manaka, Matsamela Manaka, who passed on, Selbin Vusi, I'm talking about the 80s. And David made his business to write about the artist, in particular the black artist. And among many things he talked about in his writing is he criticized them for being trapped in the socio-economic that were produced by apartheid. Because one of the things apartheid did, apartheid didn't want black people to see the world beyond that so-called township. And David was one of the really, really hard critique of that so-called township art. At the same time, where he was wrestling himself with that kind of imagery to move out of it. So you find him criticizing the stagnation of that, and yet you find him working with the same imagery in different ways. And throughout his life, and also he committed to not only to make art, but also to set up institutions, because he believed in education. Also, he believed that artists need space. So the Tupelo workshop is one, which is well known in the 80s, which he founded with Bill Ainsley. Because what Tupelo was important about, it was a time again when black artists were stuck in this so-called township imagery, but also stuck in the figurative, where they were not experimenting much about whether the material or the kind of different images. So what Tupelo did, it offered artists about 2 weeks just to enjoy, you know, the liberty of playing with material, to discover things. And that made the breakthrough in terms of the kind of abstraction art that came out of the 80s and the kind of language that artists began to explore, because the workshops were more experimental. Tupelo means learn, you know, by being involved. It's one name. But I want to read that more as in James Baldwin's notion of breaking bread. You know, it's more biblically breaking bread. So when we come together, we break bread, we eat. You know, I mean, remember Jesus Christ, the Last Supper. You know, he brought the 12 disciples and he broke bread with them. They ate bread, they ate, drank wine. They got drunk, yeah. But David, so I think that's what Tupelo was, this breaking bread, this exploration, discovering. Artists were forced to get out of the routine in order to come out with something, which managed, because if you look at artists who came out of Beck Factory, the likes of Lionel Davis, for example, out of Tupelo, I'm sorry, Patrick Mautlwa, Sam Tlengetwa, Kea San, and many other artists who went to those, even like the late Kuren Sihlali, you will see the shift. And of course, that project was attacked by academics at the time because they didn't see it. They thought it was an importation of the American abstraction because that was the model. But it's only now that we are realizing its impact in the South African history. And for me, that was the last moment, in fact, in a sequence of moments that I call them modern development in South Africa. Before that, you'll get schools such as Poly Street, where like the likes of Cecil Scott Ness, together with Sidney Kumalo, Ezrom Lechaim, who were experimenting. And before that, there were also the early generation, the likes of Sekoto, Mangoba, Pemba. So Tupelo is the last, for me, institute that managed to give a different kind of visual image. Of course, it built out of what was happening in the 70s, especially with the BC influence, Black Consciousness influence. So that's David. So we've titled the exhibition A Visionary, a Resilient Visionary, because David constantly persisted. He never gave up to not only to make art, but also against all, to try and build this institution I've mentioned. Tupelo is one. And early 90s, he also set up the Beck Factory studio at the time when South Africa didn't have the idea of studios. You know what I mean? So, and just to finish. Sure. So what you find with Beck Factory, similar with Tupelo, they will invite artists outside of South Africa. And some people have read Beck Factory and Tupelo as a gray area, meaning that at the time when segregation in terms of race was so strong, but those spaces, of course, starting with Bill Ainsley in the 70s, that's where artists of different color will commemorate, will work, will influence each other, and so forth and so forth.
I just wanted to pick up on something which doesn't get talked about enough, I think. If we think about Tupelo in relation to David's mark making specifically, and we had a conversation about this in our discussions around the exhibition in general, about how do you describe David's style, how, you know, his mark making, and I remember that this conversation will stick with me, that the words that you used were that he doesn't have a filter, and it's a pity we don't have images here, but there are some works on Goodman Gallery's booth, so I recommend you go and have a look after this. There are two drawings of the dogs, Mgodoy. You spoke about David not having a filter, and by filter, I talk about a certain kind of training or education, and perhaps David had an alternative education to some of the other so-called modernists of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and that there was this unmediated mark making from David's thoughts and his mind to his hand. Maybe you can elaborate a bit on that conversation that we had, Thembi.
You want me to reveal our secrets now? I've said David struggled. He struggled because, as I said, he didn't have the formal training where you go to art school, how to look and how to look at things formally. And if you look carefully in his work, you'll find that things, David cannot make one mark, one stroke, and something just come to life. He had to constantly search. And my reading of that is both a struggle, but also is this persistence of searching, of experimenting. So partly there's something naive about it for those who are schooled in terms of the affluence or education elite. But also there's something refreshing about that, because what it does, unlike the formally trained artist, he comes from the other side of it to find his own way, forces in his way, so that for you to engage his work, you need to spend time, because there are layers and layers. So what I was saying to Justin is, it is out of this wrestling with the surface. Even when David paints, you could see the paintbrush is like similar like a pencil or like a ball paint, because it doesn't like depend on strokes of the brush. He has this kind of investment in lines. So even when you look at this painting, so jokingly, when I was saying, I said, there's a struggle here. You could see the man at pains. And David is one of those artists who go to studio from 8 o'clock or 10 until 5. He constantly work. You know, even his last day, he was still working. And I find that very interesting, this kind of search in terms of surface. But what it does also, it creates these like so-called multi-layers that he doesn't settle for anything. And there's a beautiful story Sisibongi Dhlomo told, that once they came to David, was working on this piece, and then this client bought the piece. They left. When they came to pick up the piece 2 weeks or a month later, they couldn't identify it, because David have worked on the piece. That was the kind of artist David was. So the piece have changed from what it was. So even the like of the young artist Blessing Gobain, who have the fortune of working with him, they can also testify that. You know what I mean? That's what that was the kind of David was. But also another aspect of David is his writing, which we've mentioned, that I said earlier, not only critique the so-called township, but also he critiqued the institute, which was so racist in South Africa, which still remained that kind of a dominant white setup. But what he did, he has a way of, David is very gentle. He has a humor. You know, I mean, he speaks subtle, but yet he raised issues at a time when no one wanted to talk about them. And so now, as we are looking at his work, but also as we are reading some of his writing, we discover this kind of, it's like a discourse, you know what I mean? And David also died, yes. He was constantly writing. Justin and I were the fortune of getting his writing that were not published, where he dedicated some text to artists he worked, whether it's Bill Ainslie, whether it's Nadine Godima, many other people. So he was that kind of, that's why I prefer to call him as a modernist in that sense.
Maybe just touching on his writing, we had the privilege of going through not everything yet. I mean, there's quite an extensive archive of writing, but just to give you some of the highlights, there's some gems of writing in there. David, as part of the Tupelo and the Triangle network, traveled the world setting up art spaces from India to Cuba to New York. And he's written about all of these experiences. I was fortunate enough, actually, when David passed away, I was actually in New Delhi at the time, and it just so happened that David set up the Koj artist residency. So I was lucky enough to go there and pay tribute to him while I wasn't able to be at the memorial service. But as Tembi said, we are working through these texts at the moment, and hopefully in the next year or two, we are looking to publish this extensive archive of texts. I don't know if you want to talk about how those texts might be curated or edited together, Tembi Nkosi.
Before I talk about the text, I just want to add what you are saying about the setup David did with Bill Ainslie and others. Because when Tupelo started in the 80s, they also transported the models to places like Mozambique, Zimbabwe, Botswana. And I think Bill Ainslie died coming during a car accident driving from. So to think of David as this resilient visionary is also to think a man that who pioneered, who kind of transgressed these boundaries that now we are wanting to open in Africa, especially within the southern. And this is at a time when even most South African artists, they didn't know their neighbors. They didn't travel. So what Tupelo did, David, is to go and say, if we are South African, a part of the continent, we cannot only speak of the continent as an imagined space. We need to go and set up these spaces. And they went there, they reproduced these models. And they didn't only reside within Africa, as Justin say, they went as far as India. So otherwise, David was this kind of, that's why I call it modernist, this kind of the international, he has a global vision as much as he was based here in South Africa. So that is important to remember. And also David believed in collaboration. We attribute so much to him, but when you speak to him or you pay attention to his interview, he always attributes his accomplishments to other people, which is true. Whether the first person who mentored him, Louis Macubela, even after Macubela, it was Bill Ainslie. And also when he met the sculptor, Anthony Carr, who came here to set up with him, he helped him to set up the Tupelo again with Robert Loader. So David was this kind of collaborator. So he believed in this community of not only creative, but also different minds. So it is that person we are trying to work with, which is not easy. In terms of the exhibition, in terms of the writing Justin is asking me to talk about is, of course, what we did in Cape Town, we put only 81 works. This was before we knew it was going to pass. So we wanted to celebrate his 81 years of being alive. And then, unfortunately, he passed on just 29 days after his exhibition opened. And many people have celebrated that, thanks David, have seen his show before he died, which is always said in South Africa that most artists are celebrated when they are gone, in particular black artists. I want to take a different view. For me, that's the painful thing, to die when you are just getting a stage. When it's time to see your work, when it's time to watch people looking at your work. So I don't want to celebrate that. In fact, I want to mourn it. Why we have to wait for them to die, or why David have to have only 29 days for his exhibition to be alive. I would like to shift that, because even when we are listening to the president, Thabo Mbeki, they celebrate this, that David saw at least. I said, no, he didn't live to die to see his work. He should have lived to see, like many other artists in South Africa, the likes of Kenrich, even the late David Goldblatt. We have a fortune of seeing the exhibition traveling around and listening to people talk about it. So it is sad for me. I don't think he died happy. You know, that's my thinking. So let's not celebrate that because he saw his exhibition in Cape Town. In fact, we should make a fuss about that so that other artists who are still alive, who are in a similar predicament, they can be celebrated while they are young, they're still alive. But back to the exhibition, what we are doing so far is to prioritize David's artworks. That's what I've said with the show. It's just to allow people to see the work. Because one of the things that black artists suffer from is we don't discuss their artworks, we discuss their lives, their biographies, their struggle, their difficulties. You know, whereas for me, I said, let's put the work, let's look at what David contributed. David is going to be remembered by all these things I've mentioned, but what is going to live and outlive us is his work. We remember Da Vinci or Michelangelo because of the painting that they left behind, not the kind of life they lived. So it is that we have tried to do with the show, is to give priority to the artworks. And of course, there's a writing also we are working on. In fact, Same is here, Dr. Same Mdlulu, wrote a beautiful piece on David's writing. Just looking at what David said, but also to think around his own issues. So the catalogue is coming, I think, the 24th of October. So the exhibition is opening on the 4th of October at the Standard Bank. And then on the 6th of November, also we'll have a show as well at WAM, the Wits Arts Museum. So we are trying not only to celebrate David, but also to ask people to dialogue with David's work. Yes, the writing, I've been sitting with them, I've been going through them. And I'm still struggling because, we have conversation, we interviewed David. So we're trying to extract as much from him. Because what we wanted to do with the show is to allow his voice. Part of the curatorial strategy I adopted was not to curate for him, to curate with him, as I do with most of my shows. So not only to consult with him, but to ask what it is that he would like to see in his show. So his passing now, he has just kind of affected that kind of modeling of thinking. But of course, the writing is going to come out, hopefully next year, if not the year after. Because what we are working on is also to invite people to write about and on David's work, but also is to publish David's writing so people can have a fortune of reading his own words.
The one point, I mean, I agree with you. Part of the reason why I asked you to mention, to talk about his mark making is because precisely no one gets into the nitty-gritty of his actual practice and style. And another aspect which I hope all of you will be able to see when you visit the exhibition when it opens at Standard Bank, a series of works which really stand out for me are a series of assemblage works made during the decade of the 90s, maybe even starting from the late 80s, I would say. And I want to talk about this assemblage because sort of the knee-jerk reaction, and it's been my knee-jerk reaction, is to compare it to the assemblage movement of the 60s in the United States. If you think about Robert Rauschenberg, which was a favorite of mine when I was, coming up through high school art history, even university level. So there's a superficial link that can be made, which I think is already quite interesting. But perhaps the reaction to or the trend towards assemblage came about for different reasons. In the 60s, there was with the advent of conceptual art, there was this revolt against formalism and perhaps David and his contemporaries like Pat Mutlawa, their trend towards assemblage was precisely a revolt against this category of being a two-dimensional township artist. Maybe we could talk a bit about that, Tembeng Nkosi.
Yes, the assemblage also it moves beyond the 60s. If you trace it back, even the likes of one way or another, Picasso at some time with the Cubist and all of that, the kind of collage. Or if you want to go to the Russian artist who did those kind of the constructivists. So I think also you can even go to the US, the likes of Romain Baden, for example. So it's not only David to work with the collage or the assemblage, as Justin would say. Also his colleague, like Sam Tlengetwa, is known for that. Also, if you pay attention to Pat Mautla, who's like less celebrated, and one of the greatest painters we have here, and his work with materials, this kind of collecting, and also Kiasan, who have worked with paper construction. So these guys are coming out of this school of this so-called assemblage. So, and yes, that was affected in particular by Tupelo, because one of the things Tupelo did, it was to experiment with materials, to ask what materials can do in terms of as a language, as a medium, as a form, right? So, and David managed, of course, at the time of the 80s, he was mainly painting. It's only in the 90s that he began to collect things and assemble them to create this. When you look at those artworks, you'll find them at one level, they are like three-dimensional. They're like objects. They're more than painting, right? They're not only just a two-dimensional, though they tend to be on the wall. So I think that's a great thing one can look at. And also we discovered things that we didn't know for the show. I remember Justin pulling things from the garage that David never showed. And that's a beautiful thing about this retrospective. These work are not mainly coming from the lenders. Most of them are coming from David's collection. Most of the 80% of the work on show are David's own works. Of course, we did have loans from private and also from like public institution. But most of the work were coming from David's own collection. And these are assemblage. Maybe you can talk because you're the one who really brought into my attention. So what you see in those work, I don't think just in these are superficial links. This is what South Africa has been suffering. That it's easier to make comparison for white artists. It's easier because not only they are Europeans descendant, they have this kind of heritage they can claim without a blink. But when you have to talk about black artists in relation to Europe or America or Asia, even Latin America, we have to always make this disclaimer. To link David with Rauschenberg is not a superficial because David read widely and he traveled. So he was in conversation with these other sides. So we should read him in that context, not as a superficial comparison. So I just wanted us to address that. And this is one of the beautiful things to think of David. Also, there's a beautiful group in Nigeria that was formed around the 60s, Art Society, led by Ucha Okeke, for example. They invented languages. I think I'm now reading, for example, Tupel on David in relation to those development that were taking place in Nigeria, because what those artists did was also search for a language, to invent a language, to name their own production. So Tupelo is not only a name of the workshop, it also framed the particular production that came out of and the artists who came. So if we were to write history as an art historian, Tupelo must be seen as a movement. Similar, we read Police Street as a moment, because the likes of Cecil Scottness, Sidney Kumalo, Ezra Mlechayo, you could see a particular visual kind of register that is shared by a number of artists. Because if you look at Scott Ness's work in terms of the panel, you look at Ezra Mdechayim, you see a kind of, like SB, I'm sorry, you could see some relation. These guys were in conversation, right? You look at Sidney Kumalo's captures, for example. They were also looking at the likes of Henry Moore and other so-called non-South African artists. They were looking also in West African sculptures to find new language. And of course, Europe has been doing that with the likes of Picasso. Even the Gauguin, they have to go out of Europe to discover not only what you call it, the exotic images, but the language. So David in the 80s is doing the same thing, to go outside of South Africa. And fortunately, he was penalized for that, which is good. You know, I mean, a great friend of mine, an art historian who passed on, he passed one day to rectify that history, to say, I got it wrong in the 80s. Because remember, Tupelo was attacked, especially by academics. As interesting now, even when we are doing the catalogue, when you read the likes of Stephen Sack, who are writing beautiful essays, Ricky Barnett and others, revisiting this moment.
When you say he was kind of attacked, was that because he was breaking with the mold of other, let's say, black artists at the time? Or because he was, what was the reason for that?
Two reasons. One, as I said earlier, Tupelo was seen as an import of American abstractionism. That's one. And two, remember, the abstract expression movement was accused. There's truth in that, there's also not truth, as part of the CIA project. So they saw it as part of that kind of propaganda penetrating South Africa. The second argument is that also, remember, the whole, Americanization of the world with Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher. So it was seen as part of that kind of America, for example, like what they call it, McDonaldization of the world. So that was the critique, which is valid at some point. But what they failed was that artists appropriate, and also artists, in order for them to grow and stretch, they have to go outside of their boundaries. This is not new. Whether you read about the European artists, if it was not, let's say the guy who discovered the perspective, Brunelleschi, he had to leave his own town to discover somewhere else. So what I'm saying is, for black artists, they are penalized when they do that. Because they must be confined, they must be contained, they cannot be part of the world. So that's what I was trying to say. But thanks that David insisted, he never bowed down, he continued. It's only now that we are catching up. to see the weight of that project. But that project didn't start only with Tupelo. As I said, it started with Bill Ainslie, who opened his house. We invited even the likes of Dumile Feni, William Kenridge. These artists used to work at that space. So in other words, David was advancing a certain kind of cause. I don't know if I'm answering your question. So maybe another thing we must talk about is how then should we continue David's legacy? In what way should we keep his ideas alive in a way that we are doing with Goldblatt, in a way that we are doing with Picasso? And of course, I want to thank Manja, I want to thank the Fair for giving this platform. This is one way, but I don't think it should end here. So for me, that would be great just to think of how do you keep this man's ideas alive? Because he didn't only make art, he created institutions. We are told it's 50 minutes, it's your time to ask questions.
Ladies and gentlemen, if there are any questions at this point, very insightful reflections coming across from this panel. Butkwezi.
You talked earlier about this idea of inventing a language. I think it's interesting for me that some time ago you yourself participated in a conversation with Uma Bacha, and he was also talking about his drawings that he did with Dumile Feni in the 50s, and how he said during that conversation that they were also trying to find a language. Now, I'm just interested in your thoughts about how, for instance, the mark making or the aesthetic, more than the subject matter or more than the methodology, speaks to that search for a language and what that language does in a in a context of a South Africa that is where the black majority is marginalized. How does that become political? How does that link to, for instance, black consciousness? And I'm trying also in the same with the same question to address the exhibition that Same did around the black aesthetic. What's the connection between the black and the aesthetic?
By the way, that's Kwezi Gule, the curator, chief curator JAG. Thanks, Kwezi, for your complicated question. Yes, the language, all artists, I think the priority for any creative is to discover a language, the way we speak. I think the best way to answer a question, if you think about jazz, you think about improvisation, the kind of grammar, I think that mark making, this kind of assemblage, the collecting of material and turning them into something that are meaningful, it is that kind of language. But of course, David's language, it has something of what you call, it's somber. It's there's something, I won't say sad, something like that is troubling about it, disconcerting, maybe that's a word, gloomy, that's a word. You know, even when, for example, it's not only the dogs, David is always celebrated for the dog. David painted birds. He went to the park. You'll find a series of birds in painting, in drawings, in etching. You know what I mean? So it's not only the dogs. But what I'm saying, when you pay attention, the way you treat them, there's something disconcerting, something that gloomy. As if, in his words, which Thabang have read, because he was concerned with the human condition. The human condition that is not favorable. And Joburg, as much as it's vibrant, as much as it's diverse, but also it's suffocating. You start to see that in that. It is that kind of language. Similar when you listen, let's say, to Miles Davis, the early works, or you listen even later to likes of Hebitwaedi's bass, or Zimngawane's saxophone, or Fairfaku. You know what I mean? You could hear that there's pleasure in these melodies, but also there's something that is really troubling because of the pain, of the black pain, of the social death, of the non-being, of the zone in which we are. So you start to see that in David. You know, I don't know if I'm answering you. So it is that language that on one hand, if we were to use Roland Barthes' notion of the pleasure of the text, the jouissance, you'll see there's something beautiful, but also there's something troubling about it.
Hey, Tembi. I found it interesting when you spoke about the black artist being stuck and being suffocated. And then as a young black artist, one of the arguments I have is even conceptually, a lot of I find myself, yes, I want to speak about the condition of the black body in the world. I'm very interested in that. I want to speak about my environment and how I'm being suffocated. And then I have, there's this counter where like the art world finds that sexy. Like they want the black artists to speak about their black experience. And then there's something very sick about that for me. But then like, how do you engage with those topics and yet also engage with that part of it? You know, how do you come out of that being stuck in those concepts, in those ways of making, those ways of thinking as a black artist?
Justin, you must chip in here. Don't allow me to be crucified. I think, Teresa, you are coming at a time that the likes of David have done the work for us. And also South Africa is in a different space where I don't think young artists must be obliged to only think about the social problems. I think artists should be freed, especially younger people, to want to go to space, to travel to Mars. I think we are in that moment that, you know, I mean, when I follow the whole discourse on Afro-futurist, there's something for me that is revealing. I don't think you should be burdened by the problems. That is not our making, as Steve Biko would say. The problem that South Africa is not our making. That's a white problem. They made South Africa to be what the shit is. But yet we are burdened to try to address it all the time. It takes away joy from us, right? So the liberation we fought, the democracy we have, is not even benefiting us to the great extent that we are supposed to. So what I'm saying to younger people, I think for them, they must take flight. I'm not saying they must be ignorant or blind to social problems. It's then that they are going to offer us other worlds. Because, you know, I mean, if I, like, what I've been reading in novels, there's something so beautiful about the language and the world people are talking about, their own experiences. I want to see that in visual arts. And this is already happening in music. If you follow the young jazz musicians, Sesonke, Konti, Bukane, you just name them, the kind of sounds they're making, it's so beautiful. Yet you would feel that it's South Africa, but they're opening up something. They're conversing with musician in Europe. They're conversing with musician in America, but they're beyond this so-called entrapping country. So I do encourage that younger people, they should not be only focusing on problems, but they should not be blind to those problems.
If I can just add, I mean, I think also, you know, there's sometimes a shame attached to you know, black artists when they don't focus on the plight of their people or through their work. But I think precisely by finding, you know, these other worlds, you are liberating yourself and the community around you. So I don't think it's an either or, you know. I mean, yeah. I mean, and I agree largely with what Tembi is saying.
Hi. I've been fortunate enough to be photographing David's work for the last few years through the Goodman Gallery, and it's been amazing how much work. He was incredibly prolific. And so I've got a two-part question. The first is, as curators, how did you navigate this abundance of work, and how did you make your selections to represent his life's work? And secondly, have you noticed any like thematics in different periods of his life? You know, was he concerned with different things at different phases of his life?
Thanks, Anthea.
I'll jump in because I've probably had the most time. I've spent the most time with David's inventory in the last couple of years. I mean, yeah, it's been a daunting task. You know, last year and earlier this year, we did a few trips to David's studio and to David's home, and just the volume of work is incredible. And even in David's studio, which hasn't changed largely for the last 30 years at the Bag Factory, together with him, he was kind of directing me. He was kind of remembering almost as a map all the works that were hidden behind piles of things in his studio. And he was like, And as I pulled out things, there were you could explain and give me a narrative as to what when he did this work and what it meant to him and so on, which was an incredible privilege.
To add on that, you should mention in Cape Town, I could see he was so sad when I have to cut some of the artwork out, because I remember, you know, he was like, "Hey, but what about this Timbi?" I said, "No." No, it was a very challenging. It's true. And I can even say, will tell you, the delays in just sending the list, the final list, it was not because I was not working. It's just what you leave, what you include. Even when we arrive in Cape Town, we're like about 90 works or something. And then we have to cut. Just the pain of saying, we cannot fit everything. So in other words, your question, it's still haunting me. Even now coming here, we are sticking to the 81 works, but we are switching like few of them. Again, it's difficult which work are going to pull out, which work are going to bring in. So what you'll be seeing on show is just a fragment of David's work. It's not even a half. We could not fit. There were prints. We have to cut things out. And also in terms of themes, we've mentioned here the dogs, we've mentioned the birds. Also, David did beautiful scenes of women. They call it the ladies of the night. You know what I mean? The sex workers, if you like it. Those are stunning images of these women, like lipstick at night. And also, you'll see David also painting buildings in terms of just the flickering light. You know Joburg at night when you see the light, the buildings. So his subject, there's a range of it. But we tend to focus on his Mgudui in most of the time. But there are also these images whereby they're non-figurative, but they're about the city, the scape, and so forth.
And I think what was interesting is we found David was working in his garage up until a month or two before the retrospective. And we actually decided, well, Temi decided to include these very recent works. And I think these works, they're quite different to everything else he's done. And it was almost prophetic, you know, almost like this last chapter. Mm-hmm. There were these very long canvases, unstretched canvases, very expressive sort of paintings of human figures dancing. Mm. Sometimes obscured by a lot of paint and mark making, but I think there was this kind of freedom that was being communicated in that last series.
To add on that, by the way, I bump on the critic Sean O'Toole. He said exactly that. He said, it was so great to see David's late works. There was something about joy and happiness, something liberating about it. You know what I mean? So I'm just trying to concur what you're saying, that in those last painting, to use your word, prophetic, that he knew maybe life was already, you know, at its end. You could see David becoming lighter. As I said earlier, his work are really gloomy. But with those last painting, there's something that is fresh, something that is joyful. I just wanted to add on that, because that was Sean, he couldn't make it for the talk. He just made that comment as I met him when I was coming here.
I think maybe that's a good way to sum, or maybe the last sentence from me was that David remained fresh until the end.
Are there any more questions?
I want to know, maybe this is a question to Goodman as well, about David's legacy and what's happening now, what's going like in light and of what's happening to Dumile Feni and his legacy and the drama around that. I would like to know what's happening. Like, we know about the exhibitions and the writings, but what's the way forward in terms, because I feel like a lot of black artists that have died, you know, the kind... There's always a drama afterwards, and no one really is. There's a lot of confusion. No one really knows what's going on. There's many rumors. So I just want to know what is the way forward in terms of his legacy and his estate and everything.
Sure. So David had the foresight to sit down with the Goodman Gallery long before he passed away to plan ahead for the eventuality of his death. Not only with himself, with his wife as well, who's unfortunately couldn't be here because she's in church. So there are certain structures that have been put in place now that he's passed on. There's now a period where the estate has to be wound up. His wife is fully in control of that process. She's got, you know, legal representation. The Goodman Gallery is supporting her. And so she's leading this process with the support of Goodman Gallery.
Of course, I haven't been in part of those conversations. If you were to ask me what needs to be done, maybe this is what some of us should propose, is that museum like WAM, Wits Arts Museum, that's where David needs to be represented. I think his legacy needs to be hosted, his work, his writing, his correspondence, his archive. It needs to go to a museum that is going to allow people further research. It's going to allow student access to it. It's going to allow the public. And in South Africa, we only have one so far, the museum, which is, there's two in fact, it's the Wits Arts Museum. Of course, there's one in Cape Town like MSTN, but the Wits is more public than. So I think that's where I would see David's legacy in conversation with Goodman, in conversation with his wife. Similar, for example, when I was reading Ginsberg's collection of the books. So when you read these kind of developments, it gives you joy because people can have access in these books, at books. So I see no reason why David should not be part of. And by the way, Wits gave David an honor degree that I have to fight for 2 years for him to get it. So it is ideal that his legacy to be housed at Wits, a university that never invited him to teach, right? And yet most of the lecturers, including Penny, they use Berg Factory. So that will be the way for me, way forward. Of course, in conversation with Goodman and the wife, because I think that, yeah.
So just in closing, if any one of you is willing to take it on, can you say something about David Goloane as an institution? I think you've sort of touched on it in different facets. But I mean, the panel that we had yesterday talked a great deal about cultural institutions and institutions as material building. For instance, there was a panel on the Novel and the Zeitz Mocha. But in David Goloane, one could say we have a human institution that has given so much, that is yet to give so much still, even in his sleep, right? Can we just elaborate or give us some thoughts on Ntate Goloane as an institution for the arts?
I'll say briefly, and Justin will take the last word. David is an institution, as I said, I mentioned like two, three projects here, Tupelo, I mentioned Beck Factory, but also David established, there's a scholarship on David that afford young artists time, 3 months to be funded fully, as David would like, for them to work. And that has also been stretched into curatorial at some point. It was a moment also into writing. It's been like stretched. So yes, David, he is an institution. And as a human institution, it's that we need to nurture. Not only his ideas, the kind of things he left us. You know, I mean, in the curatorial, I use the word, and I quoted B, with a gift that South Africa needs to make South Africa a human place. You know, I mean, I think David is that kind of institution. Because for those who've come across him, even when David speaks to you, he wants to tell you, unlike me, he's non-confrontational. He has a way of, right, but yet he'll communicate. So there's a lot that we can learn from David's persona, not only his ideas. So these are things that we are wishing that, as we are studying him, also we are studying what he can give us as an institute, to answer your question.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to echo what Tembi is saying. In terms of a physical institution that is left behind, I mean, we have the Bag Factory, it's there, you know. We've got the roving Tupelo workshops, which, you know, every once or twice a year occupy a physical space. But in terms of David as an institution, what he leaves behind, for me at least, is this interpersonal relationship. So the institution of a friendship, of mentorship, you know, the time that he gave to younger artists, to colleagues, without asking for any kind of reciprocation or any kind of compensation. I think that's the institution that we need to somehow keep the roof over.
Thank you very much for that very interesting panel. May we please give them a round of applause.
Thanks again to Tembi Nkosi-Goniwe and Justin Davey. And to Art Joburg for arranging this important talk and for allowing me to post it on the Unframed platform for many people to listen to. Please support Unframed by following us on Facebook and Instagram and share the episodes that you like with your friends and networks. If you like what you have been hearing so far, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Facebook. Thanks for joining me today. See you next time. Bye.